Hello to you all, and welcome to another episode of Historical. This is part two of a multi-part podcast. After this, there'll be one additional episode that will round up our top 10 Ancient Special Forces, or ASF. These Ancient Special Forces often single-handedly made decisive impacts that could change the course of a battle, or certainly inflict larger casualty numbers on a foe, or simply make a quaking infantryman reach for a spare pair of easy wash underpants. With me, as always, to help me guide you through this myriad of expert killers and psychopaths is Wayne, who's not a psychopath. Mr. Bridgman, how are you doing today?
Yes, they're approved in court. Thanks very much, Matt. I'm rather well, thanks, actually. Yes, the rash has cleared up, and thankfully...
That's always good. But, bit of pseudo cream, maybe, on that.
But tell me... Yeah. What are we talking about today? No, well, don't. That's okay. A rhetorical question. Because last time we kicked off the Ancient Special Forces podcast, easy for me to say, with the foaming mad, bearded Viking berserkers, the mysterious heart spot, and strangely assassin-like Germanic ghost warriors. Remember them?
Yes.
And the fancy and highly trained human sacrifice addicts, the mighty Aztec Sean ones.
One of my favourites, yes, they were good.
And, well, all very different, of course. Some used shock and awe, others stealth and precision, and all of them probably high levels of combat readiness, Matt. They're ready for action. Yes. I'm sure our listeners, though, are gagging to find out who could rub shoulders with these three. So, let's leap into action. Leap, Matt.
Yes.
And find out... who, if you could do the honours, please, tell us who our Special Forces number four is.
Okay, well, let's leap into action like a foaming berserker into battle. Well, they're a hard act to follow, as you rightly mentioned, but for our next Special Forces unit, we go all the way back to 193 AD.
Yeah.
Anno Domini.
That's right.
To the great port city of Byzantium.
Which was later to become Constantinople. Of course, Matt, the seat of power for the Eastern Roman Empire. And now, sadly, of course, it's known as the Turkish city of Istanbul.
One to visit, though, on the holiday list, I think. In 193 AD, the city is months into enduring a painful and prolonged siege. The Roman Empire has targeted it for conquering. And under the command of Marius Maxwell...
Tough guy.
He had his army. Yeah. He had his navy at work to bring the city down. There were hundreds of warships blockading the great famous port of Byzantium. Outside the walled city, a large Roman army was encamped, waiting to assault the city when the time was right. The city is starving. People in this city are so hungry. Wayne, hungry!
Yeah.
They're forced to eat boiling leather.
Oof.
And they're attempting to eat it.
Oh, God. Well, maybe they're now so desperate, Matt. If, you know, if you were back then, picture yourself back then in that starving city.
Yeah, I can.
You know, it might be that they're so desperate, they might even consider eating one of your cooking creations.
Ah, that's crazy.
You know, and
that's crazy.
Well, actually, maybe might seem a bit harsh, listeners, but, you know, you haven't seen it. I mean, I guess firstly, actually, it's not really fair, Matt, is it? It'll be, well, the leather, I guess, first would
boiled
come.
Leather.
And then it'd probably turn to cannibalism. Surrender after that, death, then last resort, you're cooking. Actually, I'm glad what you did to that chicken is now a national crime, actually subsequently adopted by the European Union.
Well, it's a different way of stuffing a chicken, that's all I'll say. And it's certainly a way to keep slim, listeners. Now, the city was desperate to somehow break the siege and allow enough boats into the port to bring food and supplies for the starving masses.
Yeah.
So step forward, Wayne, a very unusual special forces.
Who?
The Byzantium Combat Divers.
Byzantium Divers. Now, we can think of the Byzantium Divers as the Navy SEALs of their day.
Yeah.
They could conduct operations at sea using stealth and guile.
Always.
Combination.
Good combinations, yes.
These guys were basically, Matt, like an underwater frogman nut before humans had even invented the rather critical... oxygen tank.
Well, that's pretty critical, actually, isn't it? Yeah, a frogman with no oxygen tank.
It is. It would be for us. For them, thing it's slightly different. Now, let me tell you why. Now, the advantage of having a free diver unit, Matt, within your navy would be principally for surprise and invisibility factor.
Yeah.
If you're underwater, effectively you are. To be able to swim underwater long distances without detection, surface, without a sound, and surprise an enemy that thought he was safe and secure... these guys, they could sabotage ships, kidnap or assassinate key personnel, and after all of that, swim off without detection.
Or die and fail in the mission.
Yeah, normally happened. But yeah. the point is, Matt, that they tried.
Yeah, no, that's amazing.
And in some cases, they were very successful, as we will hear.
So as Wayne intimated, as we both said, actually, of course in those days, no breathing equipment was available.
No.
So these guys had to learn at a very young age how to hold their breath for a long period of time. Plus learn how to fight and do essentially DIY underwater.
DIY, yes. And we know how hard DIY can be at the best of times, even the dry.
Yes, we can. Yes, we can,
remember actually how you replaced every window in your house before discovering you had a crack in your glasses?
Oh, remember man. That? Okay, so they had... Right, so back to these Byzantine divers, right? So they had to do this quickly and efficiently so they didn't have to surface and risk detection. Or before, of course, they passed out and drowned.
Because they're holding their breath.
For all this time underwater. At the Siege of Byzantium, these ancient frogmen had a plan to help relieve the food shortage of the city and hopefully reduce the impact of the navy blockade. But to pull off this plan, they would need to swim from the harbour at night, swim up to the rows of blockading ships, silent and secretive as a rather paranoid squid
for example. Or a sea turtle.
And then when close up...
Or dolphins. Dolphins are friendly. These guys aren't they?
Well, they're quite friendly. But when they're up close, right, swim from the, you know, up to the ships. When they're up close, they would dive underneath the waterline of the ship.
Yeah.
But why the hull of the hull. Ship?
Yeah.
It sounds a bit unusual they would do that.
I think I can see where they're going here. So, when they got under the ship, Matt, the frogmen would be required to attach, see if you can visualise this.
Yes.
Attach a wooden bracket with a sort of a metal loop to the underside of the hull.
Right.
Can't visualise it yet.
Yes.
Let me carry on.
Okay.
So to secure this bracket in place, it would require them to nail in 4 nails. I mean, nailing in 4 nails underwater, that sounds really difficult. Try doing that at your home in the bath, listeners.
Yes, that is difficult.
And they needed...
For their plan to work, of course.
Yeah, to do this 4 to 6 times, they had to do this.
Per boat.
Yeah, per boat. So this bracket goes on 4 to 6 times.
Mm-hmm.
You do the math. The frogmen, they would work in teams of 4 to 6 while they're doing this, though.
Mm-hmm.
This in itself is an incredibly difficult task. I couldn't even visualise myself how they managed to do this underwater. So put yourself in there. You're in the cold sea, in darkness, guiding yourself by touch and feel, silently hammering away.
Maybe like a blind man in an orgy.
Exactly.
He had to feel his way around.
Exactly like that. Hammering away in those brackets in the right place. So it took years of training and dedication. Swimming while wearing a blindfold, actually, Matt, which led the divers to this level of capability.
That's incredible. This actually scares me, the thought of swimming with a blindfold on underwater. So what's remarkable on top of this is the fact that attaching these brackets would take 4 to 6 minutes in total, all of which they would be submerged underwater trying to attach them. Now, 4 minutes underwater doing physical exercise is very tough.
Above water.
Modern scientists have studied this kind of activity and they measured that this is equivalent to 4 times the time set. So, for example, sat just still.
Yeah, so you need to oxygenate the muscles.
So imagine it's basically 4 minutes to attach this underwater doing all this exercise to give the equivalent of actually being still. It's a multiple of 4, making that 16 minutes, listeners, sat in your car, not doing anything, listen to this podcast.
Ooh, hard
to conduct
work.
A similar feat to what these divers
hard
doing.
Work, of course. Don't hold your breath whilst diving, of course, listeners. We don't want you passing out and having a rather nasty accident, but you get what that means.
Yes, good point. Yes, I mean, just holding your breath stationary, see how long you can do it. For goodness sake, 16 minutes is ridiculous.
After our watery warriors had attached the brackets, 4 to 6 sets per ship, remember, they would thread the rope they'd tied to their waists through the loops in these brackets.
That they'd attach to the ships.
That's right, yeah, tie them on. And still holding that same breath, they'd finally get up to surface, silently, remember, of course, take them a few deep breaths, and then submerge again before swimming away. It is worth noting, of course, sadly, many of the divers died during this activity. Some lost consciousness and drowned, of course, and some were spotted when they surfaced and shot with a bunch of arrows.
Oh, man, that's not nice, is it? That's not good. The last diver, though, would swim down to the ship's anchor and cut the ship anchor's rope.
Oh.
Now, back to the ropes that the divers had attached to the hull of the ships. Where did they lead to? Well, they led to the shore and into the hands of multiple teams of hidden Byzantine soldiers. Each group of Byzantine soldiers held one of the six ropes. On a single rehearsed order, they pulled the ship.
Remember, it had its anchor cut, so the ship was helpless to resist.
And they pulled it to the walls of the city. The crew, helpless to stop this, either awaited their fate or jumped overboard to save themselves.
You'd panic, wouldn't you? Yeah.
Once at the foot of the walled city, the army would storm the ship, kill everyone and take the loot and the possessions of the ship on board and take them into the city.
Ah, right.
But let's go back there and just see how well ordered and organised these Byzantine soldiers were.
Yeah. Okay, men. Now, most of the professional soldiers are manning the walls. So you need to... Well, never mind. So you need to step up now and become soldiers for Byzantium. Okay. Forget your previous lives as criminals, rascals, and ne'er-do-wells, for your moment has come. Has come to prove yourselves for Byzantium! Now, say it with me, men. For Byzantium!
So, what are we doing here, Captain? We gotta pull this rope, have we? I mean, why is that? I never done it before. Yeah. I ain't done the rope pull before.
Yes, yes, I've explained it. I've explained it four times already. You pull the rope after I say tug. Now,
Byzantium! I mean, it seems pointless to me to be pulling the rope. I didn't sign up for rope pulling, I didn't. I killed men, I have. I'm a killer.
Silence, you fool!
I'm a killer.
Look, our skilled divers, they risk life and long to get us in this position. You're buggering it up. Now,
I don't mean
it. Countdown. One for Byzantium. Two. Come on, men. Three.
What am I pulling on? I mean, I'll tell you, look, Astopheles isn't helping. He's over there, and he's tugging on something. I'll tell you what, ain't no rope he's tugging on. Astopheles!
Silence! Now, try again. Do it quicker for you. One, two, three, and tug! Astopheles! Stop tugging yourself off and pick the rope up, you simple-minded buffoon! Oh, I wish I had the bloody Roman soldiers here.
Are we tugging, sir? Are we tugging? I'm ready to tug.
Tug off now! It's coming! It's coming! Wow, what an insight into life back in those.
It was almost as if you were really there, wasn't it?
Yeah. Now, during the siege, man.
So about ambiotic.
Yeah, it is.
Ambiotic? Or ambiance? It's an ambiance.
Now, during the siege, they did this to around 25 ships, actually. 25 ships.
25 ships they did this to.
Amazing. Of course, fear spread in the Roman marines that their ship might be next.
Yeah.
So, the actions of the divers helped prolong the siege and boost the morale of the besieged city. So, presumably, these brave specialists were rewarded by their courage and dedication and delivered the city to freedom, Matt. Freedom!
No, the Romans won, actually, which is a bit of a shame. But alas, even with these ancient Navy SEAL operations taking place, it was not enough to save brave Byzantium from the power of Rome.
Oh.
So the city fell and was taken by the Romans.
Oh, okay. But the Byzantine diver is an incredibly skilled special forces unit, Matt. I mean, to be able to train and submerge and be so skilled whilst underwater definitely takes them. You know, it makes them an incredibly useful unit, doesn't it, to having your navy? I mean, a very different type of unit, I guess, than perhaps you associate with the ancient world. But they must be successful in the future, right? You know, after all that arduous training and display of courage and such?
Well, very little is known about them after this, so I would imagine not, unfortunately. But an amazing unit nonetheless. So moving on from the divers, the ancients, combat divers, very highly skilled units, probably our most skilled unit so far we've covered. Let's move away from Byzantium to a different kind of kingdom. Oh yes, let's move away to the animal kingdom.
One of your favourites.
So listeners, that's just a little taster of the animal kingdom.
Very moving.
To maybe create some ambiance. So, this special unit was indeed the ultimate in shock and awe on the ancient fields of battle. So, to introduce it, Wayne?
Oh, hang on, I know. I think, Matt, here, this is perfect. I think we can use the visualisation of a boxing match, or a boxing contest. Do you know how they do the announcements on a boxing match?
In the red corner, that kind of thing. Right. Oh, yeah, okay, let's have a go at that. Okay.
Let's have a go.
So, in the red corner, wearing some freshly soiled stained shorts and smelling like a latrine, quaking in fear for his almost certain impending doom and horrible, horrible death, weighing in at almost 180 pounds and standing a modest 5'5" in height, armed with his full square shield and short stabbing sword, it's your Roman legionary, Pantius Chatunius.
And in the grey corner, wearing a long coat of armour made of the finest mail, a specially designed helmet complete with ornamental horn that fits over his unusual face, a large leather saddle adorns his immense back, and a standing platform for free riders, all expert archers, weighing in at a healthy 9,000 pounds, standing 11 feet high, 2 6-foot tusks with a huge swinging appendage the size of a leg. It's his trunk, listeners. This is a family boxing match. Now stands one supremely confident and rather angry in season Carthaginian war elephant. We welcome the magnificent Brian!
Remember the rules, guys. Trampling, crushing the bones and biting are all welcome. The winner is by points or KO, as long as that KO includes being trampled into a small greasy smear on the ground. Fight!
Nice elephant, handsome monkey nuts. I've always loved the Loxodonta. I see I even know your proper Latin name. No, not the face, not the face.
So I think we'll all agree that was a rather poignant,
moving,
yes, depiction of a Roman legionary facing off against a armoured, deadly Carthaginian war elephant.
Terrifying, really. I mean,
called Brian.
Certainly makes you think.
Although we're not certain where and when elephant warfare began, the earliest evidence of the domestication of the elephant is a Mesopotamian relief.
A relief, of course, I should say. That's an old form of sort of like a carving of stone or something like that. Not a Mesopotamian man. And pleasure again.
It's dating back, this relief was to 2500 BC.
Yeah.
Elephant warfare likely spread from India to the Persian Empire. In 331 BC, Alexander the Great encountered Persian war elephants at the Battle of Gaugamela. Although the elephants saw little action in battle,
as in fighting,
their presence on the battlefield encouraged Alexander the Great to adopt the captured elephants into his own army. But more on that later.
Quite an accolade. Alexander the Great himself adopting you. So, in the Mediterranean, the Egyptians and Carthaginians began acquiring African elephants for the same purpose, Matt. The first major use of war elephants in Europe came at the Battle of Heraclea in 2080 BC, we are now, when the Greek king Pyrrhus used 20 war elephants to attack the poor old Romans. Why were they poor, Matt? I'll tell you. They were unprepared for such a formidable and unusual foe slash weapon, as we saw earlier, and were promptly routed by their uncomfortable encounter with these, to them, strange devil beasts. Now, remember, the elephants used in battle were not like the cute ones with long eyelashes that you see at the do today, sort of placidly chomping on a bit of straw. No, These boys, they were big and aggressive and trained to cause maximum damage.
And the Romans were rightly terrified and completely at a loss on how to tackle and fight such a beast. They basically panicked and ran for it.
Very wise.
This victory inspired Carthage to develop its own war elephants and deploy them extensively.
Though rather unsuccessfully, it turned out.
In the First Punic War. After all, this was mainly a sea, sort of naval battle, and an elephant was next to useless on a boat. If anything, a downside.
Yeah, I mean, really. The grey things that sailors are worried about going through the water are normally not elephants.
Whales.
Sharks, that's what they're worried about.
Oh, yeah, sharks.
Anyway, that must have been equivalent, Matt. Picture that, you know, arriving. I've seen it for the first time. It must have been equivalent to the tank, I think, arriving on the battlefield in World War One.
Everyone stood staring, mouth agape, at the size of the trunk of this beast.
Yeah, so suddenly the soldiers would basically glance down at the shafts in their hands and then at the elephant's size and feel very inadequate.
I'm sure a feeling we're all familiar with.
A feeling I know all too well.
Yes.
Well, what I mean by that is the spearmen in the Roman ranks must have felt like they could have done very little to stop the powerful beasts, armed as they were.
Impotent, maybe. They were the tanks of the ancient battlefield.
They were.
An elephant charging into a group of soldiers or cavalry could decimate an ordered formation that had taken years and years and years of drilling to create. Once the close formations were broken up, other units on the side of the elephants could move in for the kill. And that's assuming the sheer psychological impact of watching a giant war beast with pointy tusks, bowmen on top of him shooting off with gay abandon, charging and shrieking like a banshee from hell, didn't first cause the opposing force to flee and saw their underpants in the ensuing rout.
Yeah, these guys, they really could smash formations, impale people on their tusks, and stomp people to death under their huge feet and enormous weight.
Yes.
They towered over the battlefield, man.
Like a lamppost.
More dangerous than that. But in addition to their brute strength and the inherent psychological impact on the enemy you mentioned, elephants were incredibly useful for logistics. Yeah, they're not just mindless killing machines, Matt. They're also highly intelligent, for an animal.
Well, careful, Wayne. Remember, an elephant has a very long...
Yeah, I know. I've seen it at the zoo when it got excited during a feeding display, and I was amazing to see how long
Wayne, I was going to say memory, a long memory. They're famous for it.
That's what I meant.
By far the most well-known use of elephants, I'm moving on now, came during the Second Punic War, when Hannibal Barker crossed the Alps and invaded the Roman Empire with 37 war elephants under his command.
Mm.
The last significant use of war elephants in the West came in 46 BC, during the Battle of Thapsus.
Yeah, classic.
Where Julius Caesar, classically, armed his 5th Legion with axes and commanded the legionaries to strike the elephant's legs.
Well, still, I'd take a bit of bravery. You wouldn't stand there and go for the legs.
Man, they didn't ask to be there, did they? Which proved effective in halting their charges and brought him victory. After all, he was Julius Caesar, right?
He never
lost a battle.
He came, he saw, he chopped down elephant legs.
He did. War elephants continued to be used in the South and Southeast Asia, though, throughout antiquity and until the Middle Ages, when the advent of gunpowder basically limited the effectiveness of the elephant as a combat unit. So, Wayne, can you explain to me the tactics in using a war elephant?
Well, it just so happens I can. I mean, it might seem as straightforward as just point elephant in that direction, let them go. But in battle, elephants are often deployed near the centre of the force they were a part of. So the idea being they'd be able to prevent a charge or launch one of their own. So a charging elephant could reach up to sort of 20 miles an hour. That's 30 kilometres an hour
pretty,
for you guys.
That's going pretty good, isn't it? That is a fair old
something
speed.
That size, yeah. And unlike horse cavalry, they weren't easily stopped by a line of infantry setting spears. So obviously horses will know that they're going to... If you try and force them to charge into a group of pikemen or guys with bayonets, that sort of thing, they'll stop. But elephants, they're quite happy to carry on going. And the elephant's thick hide gave them considerable protection, plus obviously some were armoured too at that end. And their height and mass also protected the rider, and gave archers a safe and reasonably steady platform with an unparalleled view of the battlefield. So, they would charge through a line of spearmen, the archers pinging arrows into the broken ranks, the idea being that those disrupted ranks of the enemy, who were sort of falling apart now and breaking up, could be easily attacked and picked off by infantry or cavalry, which should have very easy pickings thanks to those broken formations.
Yeah, so, makes sense.
Massive shock unit, Matt. Massive.
Huge.
Yeah, you mean you can't get massiver.
Gigantica.
Literally. Biggest land animal, so...
Yeah, I would be shocked. Mm. I would be shocked. At experiencing that kind of attack on my person.
You'd be right to be shocked.
Moreover, elephants could inspire terror in the enemy, not used to fighting them, and could cause them to break ranks and flee in fear even before the elephants charged. Horses were really spooked by the sight and sounds of an elephant. Perhaps miffed not to be the most impressive four-legged creature on the battlefield, they'd ride off in a hump. That's a camel, of course. But they were not all powerful, Wayne, for every unit has an Achilles heel.
Or four, in the elephant's case.
Yes. So a surprising weakness of this seemingly invincible weapon is that elephants are not naturally aggressive. In fact, they avoid fighting except when they're in season, as in the mating season,
like
when they're
yourself.
Feeling a bit... Exactly. We'll get a little bit like that. War elephants had a tendency to panic when they sustained a serious injury or when the driver was killed, causing them to run amok, indiscriminately causing casualties on both sides as they sought to escape. So basically, at turn times, the elephant could go literally apeshit.
Yeah, I think that's the term historians generally use.
Yeah.
Now, due to their large size, they were also easy targets for projectile weapons, Matt.
Ah, yes.
The small populations of elephants made it hard for an army to raise enough to affect the outcome of a battle, generally.
Yeah. Can't get many elephants in an army, really.
That's what I'm trying to say, Matt. Thanks
like
for making that simpler.
I'm like trying to get an army of pandas.
less effective. Just sort of like chuck some eucalyptus or whatever bloody stuff is they eat on the ground.
They got to try harder.
You've got them. Right. Now then, some armies...
The Romans were especially good at this.
...used pigs, Matt.
Oh.
The soldiers used pigs to relieve the threat of the elephants. Now, the poor pigs were coated with tar or pitch.
Oh, that's not nice.
Yeah, because I see what's going to happen here.
Yeah.
Pointed in the direction of the elephants... And then they'd set the pigs on fire, Matt, for goodness sake.
Jesus.
Yeah, now the elephants, of course, they would see the burning, squealing pork chops running towards them and, rightfully, probably as an elephant, panic. Mm. Then charge all over the battlefield, usually throughout to their own lines of their army, causing chaos and dismay.
Well, they're probably trying to save their own bacon.
Yeah, plus the smell of delicious cooking bacon would doubtless remind the enemy troops of how hungry they were. Further adding to their dismay at missing a delicious breakfast.
Damn those clever Romans.
They are clever.
Actually, Wayne, as recently as 2004, the US Army even classed elephants as a pack animal.
Jungle or something, I suppose.
Though also warned in a field manual distributed to the Special Operation Forces, the current Special Forces, that the giant herbivores,
easy for you to say,
should not be used by the US military personnel due to the endangered nature of their species.
Oh, very wise. Wise words.
And, of course, the inherent danger of riding them.
Yeah. I don't think that's part of standard training these days in the US Army now. For 2,300 years, though, armies have used elephants to help fight wars. They have used the animals for fighting, hauling heavy equipment... and working on construction projects in some cases. So elephants have a long and distinguished military career from ancient conquests right through, Matt, as we just heard, into the modern era.
And as we mentioned earlier, if there was one ancient general who was the most instrumental in the spread of elephants as a weapon of war, it was probably Alexander the Great. The ancient king first encountered elephants, as we mentioned earlier, during his conquest of Persia in 2nd century BCE.
That's before the Common Era.
Very interesting. Mm. Alexander was able to skillfully defeat the Persians and their elephants, but was nonetheless mesmerised by the terrifying beasts. He took the Persian elephants that survived the campaign and attempted to build an army of his own elephants. Alexander was always on the march, so he never had time to truly train his elephants into a more effective combat force. But instead, he used them mostly for logistical prowess, as we mentioned earlier, and the powerful psychological impact they had on their enemies.
Yeah, but this began to change as Alexander marched into India and clashed with the elephant-equipped forces of King Porus of Paruva. Here, Alexander saw what fully trained war elephants could do in combat. His spear-armed troops fought them off by organising into tight ranks, like a porcupine, but they did so at a terrible price. And the elephants would often trample and gouge many of the men to death.
And after Alexander died and his kingdom splintered, an elephant arms race ensued. Throughout the ancient world, the animal served as a potent symbol of an army's wealth, status and power.
Yes, potent.
Wayne, power. It's all about power.
More than a century later...
And status and wealth.
Hannibal led his daring march across the Alps with an army of elephants. An army of 37 elephants. We'll call it an army because that is a lot of elephants to have in one place.
Mm-hmm.
Hannibal, one of antiquity's most celebrated generals, of course, hoped to meet his Roman enemies head on with his war beasts. Ironically, as Hannibal was famous for it, this feat turned into a major cock-up slash blunder of elephantine proportions.
Elephants, not historically known for living in cold, high-altitude environments, or their prowess for scampering up rock faces.
Like some sort of elephant-sized goat.
Yes, they proved, unsurprisingly, ill-suited for the task of scaling the Alps.
Yeah.
Many died crossing the mountains. Even the ones who survived the trek became so famished, exhausted and sick. When Hannibal met the Romans in combat at the Battle of Zama, the elephants proved ineffective, half-dead, and hardly had the impact that Hannibal had hoped to instill.
To make matters worse for Hannibal, the Romans had developed anti-elephant tactics. Remember, they've seen them before. They learned from early campaigns against the Greeks,
yes,
where elephants had been used. So Hannibal lined his elephants up in front of his army, a screening force of 9,000 pounds on average, man-crushing animals, Matt. The Roman general Scipio Africanus responded by creating gaps in his lines. So when the elephants charged, the Romans funneled them through these open gaps and dispatched them, surrounding them from all sides. Sounds pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
The Romans also outmaneuvered Hannibal's elephants with javelin-throwing troops and mounted spikes on their wagons in order to wound the animals. Now, the Romans also set fires, actually, to frighten the elephants away.
We all know. Animals scared of fire. Even the mighty Shere Khan.
Yeah, a vital survival tip, listeners. If ever trapped in the jungle... light a fire and you'll be fine.
Yes.
So, Hannibal's campaign revealed several other weaknesses of employing our big fat grey friends, actually, on the battlefield, Matt.
For one, when put under extreme stress, elephants can become unruly and difficult to control.
A bit like the wife.
Yep. Some of the more aggressive male elephants would sometimes pick fights with each other, causing major disruption to the operations, as well as putting friendly troops around them at risk.
Dangerous.
Not to mention making the opposing troops laugh at the ensuing chaos and screams. After Hannibal, the Romans adopted elephants during their campaign to conquer the late Alexander the Great's kingdom of Macedonia. Yet the golden age of the war elephant was coming to an end. All good things must come to an end. At least in Europe, they had been truly terrifying force in battle, the elephant. But once tactics were developed to blunt their effectiveness, they faded from importance.
Yes, they became irrelevant.
Brilliant. That whole podcast led up to that moment of a brilliant invented
been
word.
Been waiting years to get that one in.
So enough about the elephants. Now onto a more curious, or should I say bi-curious? But incredibly effective fighting force. Wayne?
Well, for variety, we've had divers and elephants. Now, serious. How about the perfection of hoplite warfare?
The Spartans?
No, but I'll let you off for thinking that. because these guys often fought against and beat off the vaunted Spartans. I'm talking about the Sacred Band of Thebes. This is a troop of hand-picked soldiers consisting of 150 pairs of male lovers.
Really? Did I hear you right?
Yes, indeed you did. Male lovers. So, they formed the elite force of the Theban army in the 4th century BC. It's said to have been organised by the Theban commander Gorgidas in 378 BC and have played a crucial role in the Battle of Leuctramat.
Now, according to Plutarch, the 300 hand-picked men were chosen by Gorgidas purely for ability and merit, regardless of the social class.
Not for looks?
No. It was composed of 150 male couples, pairs consisting of an older Erastes, lover, that meant, and the younger Eromenus, the beloved.
Or the giver and taker.
Yeah. This small but powerful unit had started its existence as the citadel guard of the city, all chosen for their valour and skills. Uniquely, in Greek history, the entire court was composed of homosexual couples, as we talked, each man paired side by side with his lover, because it was felt that he would fight more viciously to defend not only his country, but his lover as well.
Their regular training, Matt, included wrestling.
Obviously.
Riding, you know, horse riding.
Yeah.
And bizarrely, dance.
Hmm.
Now,
keep them light on their feet.
Yeah, now, it's not your typical military options, the dancing. But these guys like that sort of thing, after all.
Perhaps dancing to the old 90s favourite It's Raining Men, or Knights in White Satin.
Well, no.
The military theme.
No, in truth, actually, the dance activity was very good for, you know, stretching and fitness, and also agility, of course, very important on the battlefield. And I should say here, actually, listeners, it's important to point out that Greeks had a very different attitude towards homosexuality. Our modern prejudices are caused by a combination of 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian-Muslim morality, you know, and Victorian hypocrisy. But the Greeks didn't see an intimate relationship between two men as a sign of effeminacy or weakness at all.
The leader of Thebes' military kept up constant training and improvement of this Theban force. Pelopidas was particularly successful at leading small unit operations, and in his hands, the 300-strong Theban court del elite, the Sacred Band, became a formidable and professional body of soldiers, fully capable of facing the vaunted Spartan hoplites in battle. Skirmishing with the Spartans year after year, the Thebans both learned the Spartans' method of making war and lost their awe of the Spartan military prowess.
Boom. And that's the key right there, isn't it? If you're going to rate any special forces, really, you have to pit them against the best of the best. Now, the Sacred Band often fought the imperious Spartans and more often than not, beat them off.
Yeah.
Beat the formations off. that is the sign of the greatness of the Sacred Band, really. It was also key that the sight of the Sacred Band would inspire admiration in their fellow troops and fear in their enemies. So the physical appearance and prowess of the soldiers was key, actually.
Mm.
We go now.
Well, actually, I will say one thing I'll say is the Sacred Band often fought, when they fought Alexander the Great, in that particular army of 300, there were four Olympians, Olympic champions in that army. So it was,
yeah, it goes
they
to
were
shows,
the best of the best.
Yeah, they were. Okay, well, with that in mind then, let's go now to a leader of the Sacred Band, speaking to his men before lining up to face the Spartans.
Men, my wonderful, toned, athletic men. Men! When you enter the theatre of war, you must make sure you turn the heads of all the men. And you make sure that they look at you as a powerhouse. A warrior more complete than the Spartan hoplite. For you are his equal, if not superior. Say it, boys!
Yes, Aristophanes the Great, we are a powerhouse, we are superior to the Spartans.
We train from dusk till dawn. We are to look like Theseus, Who slew the Minotaur?
Or Perseus, who shoved one up the Kraken, the mighty Kraken, and gave it to him a good pounding?
We wax our chests, we oil our bodies, we use perfume. We are the definition of male perfection. Say it, boys!
Yes, Aristophanes, we are the definition of male perfection. With our waxed chests and fit and toned bodies and fine subtle aromas.
Now, our ritual before battle. Everybody sit in our acceptance circle and wax your shaft of your spear and polish your helmets. I'll see you muster in 15 minutes. We will have limp Spartans transfixed on the end of our shafts by the close of battle. Say it!
Yes, Aristophanes, with our polished helmets on display, we will thrust repeatedly into the Spartan hoplites.
Wonderful.
So an interesting insight into how the troops are motivated there. Yeah. Now, the exact ages of the unit's members, Matt, are not recorded, actually, in ancient testimonies.
Unreliable, of course.
Yeah, so however, comparing them with the Spartan elite unit, the Hippes, and the Athenian Ephebi recruits, Devoto, historian, estimates that trainees were inducted as full members to the sacred band at ages of sort of 20 to 21, old enough to bleed.
Yes. an impressionable age, but obviously one where they're physically incredibly fit.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Well, obviously it's important for a soldier.
And when they get to that stage, of course, they're given their full set of armour by their erastae, you know, for a ceremonial gifting of that. And they likely ended their service probably around the age of 30. Obviously, some would go on longer.
Yeah. Now, according to Plutarch, Gorgidas originally distributed the members of the sacred band among the front ranks of the phalanx of, you know, the traditional infantry. Under Pelopidas, the sacred band was united as a single unit of shock troops. These guys going fast and hard. Their main function was to cripple the enemy by engaging, killing their best men and leaders in battle. So cut off the head of the snake.
Yeah. As a single unit under Pelopidas, actually, the first recorded victory of the Sacred Band was at the Battle of Tegira in 375 BC. It occurred near the Boeotian city of Orchomenus, then still an ally of Sparta, of course, Matt, as you know.
Of course.
Hearing reports that the Spartan garrison at Orchomenus had left for Locris, Pelopidas quickly set out with a Sacred Band behind him and a few cavalry, hoping to capture it in their absence. However, upon reaching the city, they learned that a new force had been sent from Sparta to reinforce Orchomenus. Unwilling to engage a new garrison, Pelopidas decided to retreat back to Thebes, retracing their northeastern route along Lake Capae. However, Matt, they only reached as far as the shrine of Apollo of Tegira before encountering the returning Spartan forces from Locris. What were they going to do in that situation?
They're going to get it on.
Right.
The Spartans outnumbered the Thebans at least 2-1. Remember, this is the Spartans, the undefeated Spartans. 2-1 in favour.
Beat many armies before they even come into contact, of course, with their...
Yes.
You know.
Now, according to Plutarch, upon seeing the Spartans, one of the Thebans allegedly told Pelopidas, "We've fallen into the enemy's hands." To which Pelopidas said, "And why not they into ours?"
Very good.
He then ordered his cavalry to ride up the rear and charge. While he then formed the sacred band into an abnormally dense formation, hoping to at least cut through the numerically superior Spartans' line with this wedge of Theban might. The Spartans advanced, confident in their numbers, only at first clash to have their leaders killed immediately.
Jesus.
As this was the tactic of the Sacred Band, to home in on the best of the leaders in the very opening clashes of the battle.
Yeah, so, leaders and encountering forces equal in discipline and training, and with hair probably better than theirs. Remember, they liked to comb their hair before they went into battle.
They were worth it.
Yeah. For the first time in the Sacred Band. Okay. So the Spartans faltered, Matt. and opened their ranks, expecting the Thebans to pass through and escape. Instead, Pelopidas surprised them by using the opening in their flank and this of the Spartans and hit them hard in the side.
Mm-hmm.
Must have missed.
Yep.
And broke the Spartans for the first time in their long history.
Wow, incredible. So the Spartans in this battle were completely routed with considerable loss of life. The Thebans didn't pursue the fleeing warriors, mindful, of course, don't put yourself at risk, a victory at risk, mindful of the remaining Spartan garrison stationed in Ochomenus, less than 5 kilometres away. Having proven their worth, though, Pelopidas kept the Sacred Band as a separate tactical unit for all subsequent battles there on in. So, if we now listen to a quote from Plutarch.
"For in all the great wars there have ever been against Greeks or barbarians, the Spartans were never before beaten by a smaller company than their own, nor indeed in a set battle, when their numbers were equal. Hence their courage was thought irresistible, and their high repute before the battle made a conquest already of the enemies, who thought themselves no match for the mighty men of Sparta, even on equal terms. But this battle first fought for the Greeks, that not only Eurotas, or the country between Bibias and Nasium, breeds men of courage and of deep resolution."
So how is this group of warriors composed? Well, according to Plutarch, the 300 hand-picked men were chosen by Gorgidas purely, he says, for ability and merit, and not at all how they looked. And, more importantly, Matt, in this day and age, regardless of social class.
Yes.
They got where they were by, you know,
meritocracy.
Yeah. They would have been armed, as many of the hoplite class of warrior, of course, in that time. We're talking about Greek warfare here, Matt.
Mm.
That is, firstly, with the large round hoplite shield from which hoplites took their name.
Uh-huh.
They wore probably a bronze breastplate, Matt, sometimes leather, of course.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, though, would have had bronze breastplates, no doubt resplendent with decoration befitting their position in the army. On all fours. They also wore greaves on their lower legs, which would have otherwise been exposed to jabbing spears of those opposing phalanxes.
Yes.
They were levelled against.
So this armour is also called a panoply?
Easy for you to say, yeah.
Panoply. Which would have weighed nearly 32 kilos. So pretty heavy. Heavy metal.
Mm.
I'm not going to make the joke, but heavy metal. They wore a bronze helmet.
It's a fact. Rather than a joke.
Yeah. They wore a bronze helmet, though, Wayne, on top, with plates to protect their cheeks. That's their cheeks on their head. Okay. These guys don't turn tail and run, so they don't need any other protection than the other cheeks. Probably a classic, though, Corinthian-style
helmet. They don't need butt armour.
Probably a classic Corinthian-style helmet. It would be decorated with horsehair crest or an additional bronze decoration on it. The warrior's primary weapon would be a sturdy spear, perhaps 8 foot in length, with a well-polished and hardened shaft. So it would not break when things got rough. Secondary weapon, generally a short stabbing sword, probably of the falcata style. Now, Wayne, what's the falcata style sword?
The falcata is a short sword that's they'd used to penetrate in at close quarters. So it's a bit like the gladius, but the back blade, it's not two-sided, the back blade is heavier at the top, so squared off. But then it's at the front end, it's sort of curved and heavy.
Yeah.
So good for lopping off arms and the like. And
we'll stick a picture on Twitter, and we'll stick one on Instagram as well, just so you can see what a falcata-style sword would have been.
Lucky listeners.
But expect the quality of the weapons these guys held to be of the very best.
Yeah, and also add to this the fact that these warriors were extremely well trained, very strong, tough and muscular, because they had a meat-rich diet.
Yeah, meat and potatoes for these guys.
Yeah, they were very imposing, And generally sort of towered over their enemies.
They were actually physically a lot bigger than the Spartans. The Spartans were quite squiry, really toned, squiry and warrior.
Like these a featherweight guys, boxer.
Yeah, and these guys were more like heavyweights. They were maybe a bit slower to move, but weren't they a bit like juggernauts, these lads.
Which is very important in the Phalanx, of course.
Yeah.
So you'd have quite a sight there, and they would have been the vision of perfection and power to those opposing them. And make no mistake, though the Sacred Band warriors were homosexual, there was no trace of campus among these guys, okay? These guys were brutal killers who would fight with ferocity to the death. Savage. But it took a major event to finally cause the downfall of this legendary unit.
And just to say, that legendary unit fought for 32 years and never lost a battle.
Well, yeah.
And it was always against the Spartans, almost typically against the Spartans, which is an incredible record.
Yeah, and so because of that, it took something pretty big to take these guys down finally, and as major events go, they don't come much more major than the rise of Macedon. But was it a happy ending, Matt?
A happy ending, no. The end of the Sacred Band corresponded with Philip II of Macedonia's defeat of the Greek city-states in 338 BC at the Battle of Caeranea. And that's probably not correct.
Caeranea.
This was where a young Macedonian prince came to prominence, a certain Alexander. And he was, in later years, to become quite great. A quote, though, from the source who saw this battle.
The Alexander, his heart set on showing his father his prowess, first succeeded in rupturing the solid front line of the enemy. Corpses piled up until finally Alexander forced his way through the line.
A moving description there of Alexander's battle.
Historians believe that Alexander had, quote, attacked the Greek right wing, which was occupied by the famous Sacred Band of Thebes, which was massacred.
Yeah, that's right. So, according to Plutarch, the conquering king was moved by the Sacred Band's courage. And he did, quote, after the battle, Philip was surveying the dead and stopped at the place where 300 were lying. All where they had faced the long spears of his phalanx with their armour and mingled one with another, he was amazed. And on learning that this was the band of lovers and beloved, burst into tears and said, perish miserably they who think that these men did or suffered aught disgraceful. Basically meaning that he respected them.
He did. He was overcome with grief at the sight of the men laying prone. In 1818, a British tourist on horseback riding near the village of
Caeranea
tripped over a rock.
Was it an ancient sort of male phallus with 300 signatures?
This rock, upon further inspection, revealed to be a massive stone lion.
Or lion, yes, that's right.
Erected, it is believed, in honour of that famous battle that Philip, of course, cried at the end of. The large erection served to mark the Sacred Band's resting place.
Fitting.
And I quote, in the excavation of the enclosure of the lion monument, 254 skeletons were found, laid in seven rows. We know that the Theban Sacred Band totaled 300. The two figures seem sufficiently close to give strong confirmation that the bodies belong to the Sacred Band of Thebes.
Well, quite a story. So there we are.
Yeah.
We have watery military exercises and derring do in the murky depths from the Byzantine diver, the towering, trunked, trumpeting terror of the devastating, yet unpredictable, war elephants, and finally, the well-groomed bravery and skill of the famous Sacred Band of Thebes. Not a bad set of special forces. I mean, I know which ones you'd go for, Matt. All of them are very unique and highly trained to the job at hand.
Yeah, but who to choose, Wayne? I mean, that's the question. Who to choose?
Difficult.
Do you have a favourite one of these three? Do any leap out to you as being a unit of choice to add to your army?
Yeah.
Or would you take all three? If it were me, the divers would be right out of the running for a land battle, of course.
No
point just standing there holding your breath in front of the Macedonian flanks. In much the same way as I would politely decline the addition of an armoured elephant on a fleet of ships before violently butchering the officer stupid enough to come up with a plan of putting an elephant on a ship.
So, as an example to others, you mean, butchering the...
Yes.
Yeah.
The sacred band, however, now they're right up there. I think they will be a major challenges for the first place when we have to come to our review at the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well-armed, reliable, disciplined, brave, oiled, great personal hygiene and effects, and preceded by a major reputation. I like the look of these guys.
Yeah, you like what you see? Well, me too. I find the Sacred Band a very attractive group of men. I mean, soldiers. Well, listeners, you'll have to wait and see if the Sacred Band come out on top.
They're certainly not going to be the bottom.
Yeah, but I mean, we've got
four more.
Granted, I think we've got two really strong units there coming out to go through to the next stage where we see who's going to be the best, the guys you want to take into your army.
Yeah.
So
that was great.
We got coming up next? Well, for the final instalment of Ancient Special Forces, or are we going to keep people on tenterhooks here, Matt?
Maybe keep them on tenterhooks so we can surprise you, because there'll be four in this last episode, right?
Yeah,
because we've done six so far.
Mm-hmm. So thanks for listening again, listeners there. We really do welcome your feedback, and we've had some great advice actually come through the email address. So it's been for the most part quite nice. Some of it's a bit bit unnecessary. Anyway, the email address is
exactly joking, of course.
Just joking. It's been really good, actually, some of the feedback and some of your ideas. You know, we do take these on board. It's in the notebook. It's going to be looked at.
Yeah.
So that email address is, remember, historical@hotmail.com. So feel free to send us any comments you wish.
So before we go, I just want to do a shout out to another podcast that we listen to, both of us are quite avid fans of. This one's called Binge Thinking by Tony Cox. So,
great guy.
Yep, have a listen to that. It's got quite a British focus, so it varies in subjects. We've had the Royal Navy, the history of the Royal Navy, battles of Trafalgar, a little focus on Nelson,
great,
which I really enjoyed.
In depth from the perspective of those poor souls on board as well.
Yeah. He's covered the Putney debates via the South Sea Bubble, which was something I didn't really know about before, which I found fascinating. And he's recently been doing a series on the Battle of Britain, which has actually got about 80 episodes.
75 years anniversary, of course.
Yes, it is indeed.
To the point.
There's plenty of you to get plenty of stuff for you to get stuck into there. So that's called Binge Thinking by Tony Cox, and you can get that again on iTunes as well, which is where I get most of my podcast from. So, you know, hope you've enjoyed this podcast, and we look forward to getting the last part of Ancient Special Forces number 3 out in the next month or so, and of course another one, a certain Vlad the Impaler, coming soon.
So thanks for listening, and speak to you next time.
Bye bye.